switch what you're saying on. I enlarged wet plates. These are 3.5 by 4.5 inch wet plates, and we've enlarged them to about 44 inches by 33 inches. So there are these massive portraits of the gorillas, as well as portraits of the weapons that they will be giving up as they move into peace. So if you want to learn more about Cerimon House, it's CERIMON.org. And I hope to have people come out and go into a little more depth and nuance on this. This is my first time on the radio, so.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. It's incredible, and thank you very much for going to Colombia and capturing these stories and so that we could find out more about it. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. All right.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is May 25th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Justice Within Reach on Friday, May 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Castaway Portland, located at 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. Justice Within Reach is the annual Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation Social Justice Party and fundraiser, featuring food from vibrant table catering and events, dancing with the La Ronda Steel Band, and a performance from 2017 Lila Jewel artist Taza Williams Art. Again, that's Justice Within Reach on Friday, May 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Castaway, 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
The time is 6:02 and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome, dear listeners, to Preference, an Experiment in Queer Radio. Thanks for being here tonight. I'm your program host, Alan. I have in the studio Kelly Simon, staff attorney for the ACLU of Oregon.
Hey, Alan.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. First thing we're going to talk about today is the executive order issued last week by Donald Trump promoting free speech and religious liberty. Is that the right... Is that the title of this?
It is, I believe, maybe the chosen title. I'm not sure if it quite captures it accurately.
All right. So Do you have a text of this?
I do, actually.
Okay. Is it as short as the what I've been seeing? It's just a few sentences, is that right?
I have one that's a little bit longer, but it's not long. That's true.
Well, I'm going to read out what this what the key points are as I understand them, and then we'll see if that compares to what you've got. The executive order that promotes free speech and religious liberty has three general points. One, it declares that it is the policy of the administration to protect and vigorously promote religious liberty. Two, directs the IRS to exercise maximum enforcement discretion to alleviate the burden of the Johnson Amendment, which prohibits religious leaders from speaking about politics and candidates from the pulpit. And three, provides regulatory relief for religious objectors to Obamacare's burdensome preventive services mandate, a position supported by the Supreme Court decision in Hobby Lobby. So I think we've got, we actually have, does that make sense?
Yeah. I would maybe say that it doesn't even go as far as those three points, but it encourages government agencies to use their discretion in those areas for sure.
Okay. Let's dig into what that means. What is religious liberty?
Sure. And I guess let's start with what's the Johnson Amendment, since I think that's a phrase that's been thrown around a lot that kind of contextualizes both this order and the kind of previous leaked version that was a lot scarier than the one that came out. But the Johnson Amendment, essentially, it's from 1954. It was introduced by then-Senator Lyndon Johnson. And it made tax-exempt churches and nonprofits, it prohibited them from engaging in political campaigning on behalf of candidates. So that applied to both churches, like you would imagine a traditional, maybe Catholic church, as sometimes becomes part of the conversation when you talk about reproductive services. And it applies to organizations like the ACLU. So that's the Johnson Amendment.
And it applies to the ACLU because the ACLU is a nonprofit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we're talking about something that gives some framework to what a nonprofit or a religious organization can engage in.
Yep. And then when you look at the executive orders, the Donald Trump seems to want to provide some alleviation from that amendment to only a small group of organizations, what he would define as religious organizations, but religious organizations, how it was defined in the original executive order draft that was leaked, went much further than nonprofits. It included for-profit companies that were closely held. When you think of things like Hobby Lobby, things like that. Fast forward to the current one, I think it doesn't go as far as what we saw in the original version, but it certainly raises concerns.
So we're talking about free speech, and of course, everybody sort of has their own definition of what's valuable about free speech and what's contained within it. What is your sense of what Trump here is asserting is an appropriate way to conceive of free speech?
You know, it's hard to tell from the executive order that came out, you know, what he would classify as free speech. I think, though, in the context of religious freedom, he's certainly looking to protect religious speech in the political sphere, even though he doesn't quite spell that out in the way that we thought he was going to.
Mm-hmm. And nudging the IRS to sort of take that those concerns in a loose sense and applying them to churches. I think this is too vague for us to know how that will play out or what that means for organizations. And no organization can guess ahead of time, of course, what's lawful or what would be considered lawful or enforceable. Do you have any sense, though, of what it means, what it might mean for, let's say, a church to begin to be more assertive with political speech or political activities?
You know, I certainly flat out lobbying, which, you know, 501c3s are not allowed to do. Candidate endorsement, things like this. Yeah, it's hard to tell. I know that I'm going to forget this, but I want to say maybe NPR did a study, but I don't quote me on that. But I was kind of preparing materials, and certainly for folks who are listening who have been to church, they've maybe heard certain candidates endorsed from the pulpit. Those types of activities actually aren't supposed to be allowed. But the enforcement that has happened around kind of this Johnson Amendment or that prohibition, as it pertains to the IRS enforcement, it's not something that's highly enforced. So when you think about what this executive order does, it doesn't do much to change the status quo right now, but it does set the stage for future federal actions that could change the status quo and could significantly threaten certain groups of people, like the LGBT community, women, people of other, what appear to me, based on the original version, people who are associated with maybe non-Christian beliefs.
Let's talk about that original version, which I think up until the day before Trump's executive order was issued on Thursday, up to the day before, people sort of assumed, took it for granted that this harsher version would be the one that would be issued. Let's talk about what's in that, what didn't come to pass, but might in the future.
Right. So, like I said, the concept of religious organization that would be exempt from this Johnson Amendment was defined really broadly. So it went beyond nonprofits and churches and included some for-profit groups. Another thing it did was define religious exercise broadly. Think of things like running a bakery, kind of doing your daily activities that we don't commonly associate with the exercise of religion. Those things were included in the definition. There were really broad sweeping exemptions from the required coverage of reproductive health services. Also, Health and Human Services had to exempt organizations with religious objections from contraceptive care coverage requirements. And they were prohibited, Health and Human Services was prohibited from taking adverse actions against federally funded child welfare organizations that might discriminate based on religious reasons. So think of, you know, youth being denied access to foster homes because of their identification as LGBT, or families being denied the ability to adopt because of their identification as a member of the LGBT community. So it was a real attempt to carve out of both the Johnson Amendment and other kind of non-discrimination protections this group of religious folks. And the striking part about it was that it specifically spelled out three beliefs that should be exempted from adverse action. And those beliefs were that marriage were between one man and one woman, that sex was an immutable characteristic based on one's anatomy before or at time of birth, and that life begins at conception. Freudian, I don't know. This is a good slip, huh?
And so
some may think that life begins at contraception. I happen to be one of those.
So those tenets were explicitly
put? Yeah, they were explicitly spelled out as kind of protected beliefs. And it's, again, we're seeing, you know, the administration willing to just fly in the face of the Establishment Clause and promote certain religions and certain religious beliefs. And that should be really concerning to us. And, you know, you look at the new executive order, and it doesn't do that. But It does direct our Attorney General Jeff Sessions to issue guidance interpreting what religious liberty means. So I think we still need to be really vigilant in this area and be sure that we're paying attention if the Attorney General issues guidelines that are consistent with this former version. You know, you look at his track record, and that certainly is possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kelly, does this executive order or any other executive order preempt state law?
There's nothing in the current version that concerns me about state law, and it kind of depends on which state law you're talking about. But to the extent that this executive order kind of tells federal agencies what to do, it won't really have an effect on state law. And to the extent that the president is trying to define what religious freedom means, it also, that's not his job. He doesn't get to write the Constitution in the way that he sees fit. But, you know, to the extent a court would find that religious freedom would be consistent with one of these things, a federal court, it may affect state law. But right now, I am not concerned about things like our public accommodations laws that prohibit protection, which, by the way, 10 years ago today, the Oregon Equality Act was signed. So I think we definitely have cause to celebrate here in Oregon that we're taking steps forward, despite many other states not having similar protections and despite our federal government not yet having those protections.
And what exactly is this 10-year-old Oregon Equality Act?
Yeah, so what it did is it wrote into our non-discrimination laws, our Oregon non-discrimination laws, protections for people. I'm just like fumbling my words here. It prohibited discrimination against people based on sexual orientation or gender identity in things like employment, housing, and public accommodations.
I'm Alan, your host. This is Preference Radio. We're chatting with Kelly Simon, staff attorney for ACLU of Oregon. I was reading a piece. I don't think I said where it came from, but it's called, I printed up a copy from the web, it's called I Was Trained for the Culture Wars in Homeschool, Awaiting Someone Like Mike Pence as a Messiah. And really, it's a discussion of this person's individual experience, personal experience, in an evangelical conservative household and milieu, and basically, it's an argument that what they're presenting to the people in their community is an argument that the Constitution is actually a God-given document and should be interpreted as such and mutable as such. There's a sense in which the movement to desecularize the Constitution seems to exist, and maybe something that something specific to this movement that we're not entirely aware of. And I think we think about sort of other aspects about folks promoting sort of one religion as the American religion. Do you have thoughts on sort of where what this looks like? Is this, do you have a sense that this is something that's bubbling up in the state or in other states that you're familiar with? Do you have any sort of finger on the pulse of what this person calls a Christo-fascist movement?
I don't have I can't say I have a strong sense of how much that might be bubbling up, but I am from the Midwest and I do come from a fairly religious background and I do identify as queer. So all this, from a personal level, I don't think this is a kind of new culture. And I think it is a culture that exists near places where I grew up, and is something that is hard to understand, but that exists, and we should think about it. And why not talk about it? But, unfortunately disagree that our Constitution was ordained by God or somehow came down from anywhere else but a few white guys in a room. you know, I think it's important for us to remember that religious freedom does not mean that we get to conform the rest of society to our beliefs. And, you know, the executive order, just to kind of tie it back in, said the first freedom was religious freedom, the first freedom in our Constitution. And actually, that's wrong. The first freedom is the freedom...
Right to assembly?
No, it's actually the freedom from religion, free from religion. And it's the Establishment Clause that you know, we should have separation of church and state.
Now, Trump has already signaled that he himself, as he describes everything, would be willing to consider amending the First Amendment. And he was specifically speaking to libel law. He could very well have been winking to other folks that feel that their activities are curtailed by the First Amendment.
You know, I think that's a really scary thought. And I think we need to be really vigilant as Trump continues as our president continues to, you know, threaten kind of these core principles of what make us American, right? This kind of challenge that we're seeing against the Establishment Clause is a common thread throughout some of his actions in his first days. And I think we need to be really concerned about that.
I think a lot of people are really focused on either corruption in the government, in the federal government at this point, whatever that might look like, Trump sort of extending corporate protections at the expense of citizens. But that's nothing new. I think I would say that neither are new. But I think this is something that, a lot of people are looking at for the first time, at least, sort of in our, in the last X number of decades. You know, obviously it's come up before, but it feels like there's something new that we as a whole culture have to tackle with. So that's what, that's what Trump is putting out there for us, against us, whatever, to consider. You know, where do we stand on this? And some folks have a really different idea than other folks. It's hard for me to ask you to sort of speculate on where that goes. But what kinds of signals are you seeing at ACLU that maybe the rest of us don't normally encounter about where this conversation is going?
That's a good question. I might have to think about that one for a minute. Where this conversation is going. I think being in Oregon, I think there's a collective understanding that there's a serious threat here, but there's also real opportunity here. And because these things are becoming such dire kind of conversations where we're seeing so many people's rights threatened, that it's time to both stand up and defend each other, and it's also time to take affirmative actions forward so that things like this can't happen again. Mm-hmm. So I do have a sense that things are moving in a positive direction. For example, I just heard from one of my colleagues, our policy director, Kimberly McCullough, that Oregon had a secular marriage bill that is heading to the governor's desk.
Tell us about the secular marriage bill.
Yeah, so what it would do would allow other secular organizations, like secular humanist organizations, to have marriage celebrants, and it wouldn't require those organizations, people from those organizations, to find some religious minister, which would go against their kind of core beliefs, to be married free. So just like a member of a church can have a minister ordain their marriage, a member of one of these organizations can have one of their organizational members solemnize their marriage. And I'm not sure kind of the definitions and how they play out. I haven't seen the final version, but I think it's a real positive step forward to an inclusive and equal society that doesn't prefer or promote one religion over another, but allows us all to coexist.
And so we're waiting to find out if Governor Brown will sign that. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't heard any reason why it won't be signed. So, fingers crossed.
All right. Would we be the first state? Or is this something that's put in a law somewhere else?
That's a great question. I'm actually not sure the answer to that. I'll get back to you on that one.
It sounds good.
And you know, last week we saw Senator Merkley introduce a bill that would write LGBT folks into the classes of people who are protected by our federal civil rights law. So I think we're really seeing people step up and say, hey, we got a lot more work to do here if we're all going to be safe.
Wonderful. So what, let's find out what else the ACLU of Oregon is working on.
I guess to stay on topic, you know, there was the Sweet Cakes case that bubbled up and got a lot more attention last year and I think the year prior, and so we're waiting on that decision to come down. Oral arguments were at the Court of Appeals a couple months ago, and it's a great example of, you know, what religious liberty gone too far might look like. And it looks like discrimination, and it looks like people having a lot of damage. You know, I mentioned I identify as queer and grew up in a religious community, and I think it's important for us to remember that discrimination is not just this kind of vague concept that lawyers fight about, but it's this real thing that hurts real people. And, you know, it can hurt you emotionally, it can hurt you mentally for a long time and really significantly. And for some people, it can end up in a lot of physical harm. So that's one case that I'm kind of anxiously waiting to see how that turns out. What else? I can go way off topic if you want, but...
Well, first I want to mention that folks are welcome to call in. Studio number 503-231-8187. Feel free to pick up that phone. Also, we invite you to pick up that phone again later this week. We'll be beginning our spring pledge drive on the 11th. It won't overlap with preference, but I hope you'll think about in the next couple of days either becoming a member of KBOO or increasing your membership. Your contributions are what make this radio station operate, so thanks for that. 503-231-8187 is this studio phone. Kelly, what else is ACLU of Oregon taking a look at right now?
We've been spending, at least in the legal program, we've been spending a significant portion of our time supporting some folks out in the DALs, both community members associated with the Gorge Resistance and Rural Organizing Project, and folks who are being detained by ICE in the jail out there. And the jail is called NORCOR, and it serves four counties in Oregon. And it's currently contracting with ICE to hold immigration detainees with along with the jail detainees there. And from what we've heard, the conditions there are pretty abysmal. You know, lack of access to psychological and medical care, food that's been described as looking and smelling in ways that make you not want to eat. It's dinner time, so I'll be nice there with my description. You know, bugs on the walls, no socks, things like this. And so the folks who are, the immigration folks who are being detained went on hunger strike. You know, imagine conditions so bad that you would risk your life and health to make some changes, both for you and for people that might come after you. So that's the position the hunger strikers found themselves in, and the community is appalled to hear their stories and appalled that the facility in their backyard would be cooperating with ICE in the way that they are. And so we're offering legal support to both the folks inside and out.
Wonderful. You mentioned gorge resistance. Is that related to ICE, or is that related to Nestle, or?
The gorge resistance is a coalition of folks in the gorge who at least are organizing around this issue in particular, and I'm not sure if they're organizing around other issues. Forgive me, gorge resistance, for not knowing the answer to that.
Okay, thank you for that. We're going to hear a little music break in the middle of the hour. Kelly, last thoughts?
Support KBOO. Thanks for having me, and thanks to all the listeners for hanging in there with us as we wade through this murky stuff and think through these really important issues.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly. We'll bring back you and ACLU folks to check in on these topics probably later in the year.
Sounds great.
Wonderful. Thanks, Kelly. We're going to hear a little more of Crying at the Discotheque while we get set up for our next guests. We're going to be talking about the Queer Documentary Festival happening later this month. Some great programming. All right. All right, that's Alcazar, Crying at the Discotheque. That is the theme song for Preference Radio. Thanks to Alcazar. If you haven't seen the video, please go out there on the web and watch it. It's super adorable and goofy. I'm Alan. This is Preference Radio. I'm your host tonight. We're here on Preference every second and fifth Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. Here in the studio for the rest of the hour, we have Deb Kemp and Molly King. Why don't you introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Molly King, and I am one of the festival co-directors for the QDoc Film Festival coming up next week at the Historic Hollywood Theater.
Yeah, I'm Deb Kemp. Ditto that.
Yeah, it's the 11th year for the festival. I think I saw that it's the only one outside of Bucharest. Is that right?
Yeah. You got it. Yep, that's right. We're the only film festival in the United States and one of two in the world dedicated exclusively to gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and queer documentaries.
All right, fabulous. Kudos to us. And kudos to the team that's put this on. I think Russ Gage and David Weissman started it. Is that right?
You got it. You got that right.
And here now it's in your hands. Damn. So you get to tell us what's exciting this year, what folks should come out to see. But first, let's give the dates on that.
You bet.
Festival.
Yep, that's Thursday, May 18th. To Sunday, May 21st.
Okay. And where on the web can folks find information?
You can find it at qdocfilmfest.org. So that's qdocfilmfest.org.
All right. Fabulous. Deb and Molly, what should we be looking for?
Yeah.
What can we look forward to?
Well, we've got actually 12 wonderful films this year. We typically have 11, and Molly and I just couldn't resist to sneak an extra one in this year. So we have a short film accompanying a shorter long feature film, and all of them are pretty amazing. We all have our favorites. I'm personally extremely passionate and excited to see Shavela. I don't know much if you know much about the film at all.
Not at all.
Well, Molly, you want to explain a little word on that one, because she's a...
Yeah, you bet. Well, I'll digress a bit. We're kicking off. Our opening night film is The Untold Tales of Armistead Maupin. Mm-hmm. And we're kicking that off on Thursday, May 18th at 7:30. And Armistead Maupin himself will be joining us, as well as a QDoc favorite, Jennifer Kroot, who's been to the festival a few times. And she'll be joining us, as well as the co-director and editor, Bill Weber. So we're very excited about that. That, of course, highlights the life and work of the beloved Armistead Maupin, who's famous for Tales of the City, of course. Mm-hmm.
So I'll come back to Shavela, who didn't get the shout out there. wonderful film on Saturday night as well, following on from two nights. We'll have a documentary focused on Shavela Vargas, who's the most amazing Mexican singer, had wonderful love affairs with many a famous person, including Frida Kahlo. And this is a very special documentary. We both saw it at Berlin Film Festival a couple of months ago, and it should be extremely captivating for anyone who catches that. It's on Saturday night at 6:30, and obviously all the films are at the Hollywood. That's one of my personal faves.
Tell us why.
She is so sexy. She really, really is and was and will always be so incredibly captivating and talented and just oozing so much sexuality.
Indeed. I've got to concur with that. And it's just a beautifully, beautifully put together film. Catherine Gund is the director. And she will be in attendance as well, joining us for that film for a Q&A immediately following the film. We're lucky enough to have 14 subjects and filmmakers join us for the festival this year. Yeah. So all but two films are immediately followed by Q&As that are joined by either a director or subject that will be in attendance leading a Q&A. And those are always great for some pretty stimulating conversation around current events, current issues, and sometimes a little bit about the film itself. Mm. But it's a pretty wonderful experience to be sitting in a room full of LGBTQ folks and allies and talking about issues that are important to us, both with the filmmakers and subjects and ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we're almost looking forward to the Q&As as much as we are to the films themselves.
Yeah, for sure.
It says here that Shavela is the film itself is rooted in conversations,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a lot of fun. It's a documentary without that sort of narrative structure. You sort of jump in and Absolutely. See where everything goes.
That's right. Catherine and Daisha unearthed some interviews that have never been seen before. So There's some footage there that goes deeper than anything that's been exposed to date. So it definitely provides an intimate look at Shevela, more so than we've ever seen before, which I think contributes to why Deb says she thinks it's such a beautiful film. And I have to agree as well. It's just it goes deep and shows a side of Shevela that we haven't seen before, and makes you love her even more than you already did.
And you were mentioning just before about, you know, obviously films that have current political, a nod to current political circumstances. And we were talking about just before the Lavender Scares, obviously a fantastic documentary. It's going to be on Sunday at 4:30 with director Josh Howard. He's done a lot of work with 60 Minutes. He's a wonderful journalist. And, you know, if you can make it to the Lavender Scare, as much as it will shock you, our history, you know, with U.S. history in particular, as far as President Eisenhower's declaration that gay men and lesbians are a threat to the security of the country. And scarily enough, there are some sentiments that are echoed, I guess, in more present day times. So it's an extremely powerful documentary to see where we've been and remember that for where we're at now.
And this focuses on one person's
experience?
Or? Yes.
Yeah, you know what, it actually talks about the whole, the entire situation at the time where all gays and lesbians who worked for the US government were basically they were hunted down to a certain extent and forced to resign from their positions. And we're hoping to have some people who have actually gone through that actually attending the seat at the screening at the same time, so they can share just exactly, you know, what that was like. But I don't think any of them, it seems, were that aware of how much of a movement it was throughout the government. It felt very isolating and very individualized at the time.
And you're currently looking for folks who experienced this?
Absolutely. We would love to see you at the film. If you were in any way dismissed by the US government during the 50s because of your sexuality, then email us. We would love to have you there and host you there for sure.
Okay. Do you have a sense of, roughly speaking, when this, we'll call it purging, an ugly word, but it seems appropriate, purging of queer folks from the federal government, from employment in the federal government, when that tailed off, when it ended?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, from Josh's, the director's perspective, it was about a four-decade long period from 1953. So I guess that gets us through to about the 90s. Yeah.
Okay. All right, what else? We have lots of great stuff.
We do have lots of great stuff, indeed. Following our opening night of Armistead Maupin, Friday night, we kick off with Jules Cachouan, and that is highlights pioneer and trailblazer and club owner Jewel Fies Williams, and Jewel is going to join us at that film as well as the director C. Fitz, and it talks about, you know, the influence of Jewel not only providing a safe space for people in the community in LA at that time, but also all of the other wonderful things that she has done for the community, from being a health provider to a counselor to a club owner to just a wonderful person of color that happens to be queer and woman. So she's a pretty powerful person. It actually happens to be her birthday today. So happy birthday to Jewel.
Happy birthday, Jewel.
It's a great story, and it's a triumphant one that celebrates kind of a wonderful woman who provided and a safe space for people in the Hollywood community. And in addition to that, we've on Friday night, Deb spoke to this a little bit, we've got Bayard and Me and A Giant's Love. That's the double feature that Deb spoke to earlier. We're pretty excited about that. Bayard and Me is a beautiful short film about Bayard Rustin, who is known as a civil rights leader. He's one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s right-hand guys. And he had a longtime partner, Walter Nagel. And he wanted to legally marry him in the 80s, but that literally wasn't possible. So his way to their way to actually get recognition of rights and equal rights was Bayard actually legally adopted Walter so that they could actually have equal rights. So it's a beautiful and interesting story, and I'm excited for people to see it. And that is followed by A Giant's Love. And A Giant's Love is about Mariela Munoz, who was the first transgender woman in Argentina to be served, not served, to have legal documents in Argentina, thus really setting a precedent. She adopted 17 kids. Is that right, Deb?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely story about her in a time where under a right-wing military director dealt with fighting for her rights, for herself and her identity, as well as the rights of her kids. So we're really looking forward to that film as well.
Folks may remember the mural of Bayard Rustin on the building that used to house SMRC, Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center on MLK Boulevard. Maybe you were just driving by, or maybe you were headed into SMRC for one thing or another. But that was on the side of their building for several years until they moved out of that space.
Fantastic.
Is it no longer there?
They're hosted by New Avenues for Youth downtown. Mm. So, yeah.
Right.
Also, extremely exciting, our closing night film is a film called Rebels on Point. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever had the opportunity to see the Ballet Trocadero, obviously de Monte Carlo. They are absolutely amazing. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen them. Well, this is the first documentary about them. And we're super excited. We'll have one of the dancers, actually Bobby Carter, in attendance for the Q&A. It's an absolutely beautiful film. It's a wonderfully uplifting and warm story about these wonderful dancers and how successful the ballet company's been and what it's done for the community to obviously have them in existence for such a long time. So that'll be on Sunday, 7:30. It's a wonderful film.
Rebels on Point. I believe the troupe has been here as a White Bird production.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And White Bird is a community sponsor for that film, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're pretty excited to have them on board.
Great.
Yeah. We've got more to talk about too. There's more films.
Please.
I can speak to one another personal favorite. They're all favorites, but you know, just those that really get to you. There's a really interesting film that we're screening on Sunday at 2:30. It's called Small Talk. It's extremely interesting. It's basically a Taiwanese film. Taiwanese director, and it's focused on the director's mother. And over a period of time, basically, she has never really come out as a butch lesbian. And so this interview follows her for a couple of decades of her trying to understand why her mother doesn't like her and seems to resent her. And it all comes back to her mother really being quite closeted and really enjoying her life when she's with her lesbian friends and not feeling like life is that great when she has to conform to being more of a traditional wife and mother. So it's a slow moving and extremely beautiful film, and that's like I said, Sunday 2:30. It's called Small Talk.
The Notes of a Crocodile is a book by Q Miao Jing, and she was a lesbian writer, and she wrote about queer life in Taiwan. Mm. And Notes of a Crocodile is the second book she wrote, I think. And it's just been issued or reissued in English in the last month or two. So I'm super excited to grab a hold of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Notes of a Crocodile.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Sounds like something we should take notes on.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, it seems banal to say, but I'll say it anyway. I mean, there's so many cultures in the world and so much to think about, and then you know, so many subcultures in that and people's individual experience. So bringing film out of that is one way to sort of listen in, and a way to spark conversations about experiences that are, you know, often so unfamiliar.
Absolutely, yeah,
that's exactly right. And we're excited that we have, you know, a bit of a decent foreign film offering this time around. You know, Chavela, Mexico, A Giant's Love, Argentina, My Wonderful West Berlin, Germany, Small Talk, Taiwan, of course. Mm-hmm. So it's you're exactly right. It's very important to open those doors to other countries and cultures, and so that we may learn as well.
This is Preference Radio. I'm Alan, your host. We're talking with the co-organizers. Is that the right word?
Co-directors, co-organizers, co-directors. Co-chicks, chicks.
Chicks.
Chicks. Chicks
from
Q-Doc. Q-Doc chicks.
Deb and Molly, co-organized, co-direct Q-Doc, Portland's queer documentary festival coming up later this month. How many films do you watch, to put it?
We watched 44 films.
Yeah.
I think that number ranges. I don't know if David and Ross necessarily watched 44 films last year. We watched several last year too. We work very closely with David and Russ on this festival, of course, and we've learned so much from them. They are just amazing, and they've built such a wonderful legacy over the last 10 years, and so it's been an honor to work so closely beside them. But we, Deb and I, we probably watched 44 films.
Yeah.
Narrowed it down to 12.
So can anybody submit, or do you?
We are a curated festival, so we don't accept submissions. However, we do get emails from people in the industry and people randomly that shoot an email to info@q.filmfest.org with their film in mind. And we'll take a look at a screener, and if we think that it looks like something that might suit the fest, we may progress that. But for the most part, it's curated through friends of the festival, friends of the industry, and recommendations.
Do you travel to other film festivals to take a look?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, we've between the group, we've been up in Palm Springs Festival. David was over in Oslo, and Molly and I went to Berlin most recently. In fact, that's where we saw My Wonderful West Berlin, which of course was an incredible place to see it in former East Berlin, actually, at the time. But yeah, we do have that opportunity, and it's really cool to see these films with different audiences as well, and then try and picture them back in Portland and see if the audience reaction would be really similar, or whether it would, you know, be a different fit. So it makes quite a big difference where you see the film in the first place. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Berlin. I think most folks think of, and I'm just guessing on their behalf, but I think they just think of Hedwig. That's where you begin and end with Berlin. But there's more stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, come along. On Saturday, 1 o'clock, we have My Wonderful West Berlin. We're really lucky to have an awesome guy, Jochen Hick, the director, will be in from Berlin. And this film is fascinating because it basically just shows how much Berlin was a part of the early gay scene, really, in the previous century. And so it talks about, you know, what was happening in Berlin and the LGBTQ community, and then what happened when the wall went up and how that changed everything and didn't change many other things. So, yeah, really encourage, if you're interested at all, obviously, in German history and to come along to that film. But it also, again, has really crazy parallels with where we're at right now in our political system. So it's a little scary at the same time.
Do you want to speak to that just a bit more?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it really shows Berlin as a pretty liberated, open-minded city. And then what changed, really, with the Eastern Russian government influence, and how the city was then separated, yet it was the same people who were trying to exist in two different, very different cultures. And then, you know, it also progresses a little further into when those two cultures started to come back together again, and what that meant and how they were different. Yeah.
Off the top of my head, I think I believe that Germany was where sort of scientific conceptions of homosexuality, perhaps even somewhat neutral, descriptions and sort of scientific attitudes were created. So
that's what I've read as well. Yeah, but even the word homosexual in some regards. So yeah.
All right, that is my wonderful West Berlin. One of the films I absolutely expect to sell out is The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, it's getting rave reviews in the it premiered at Tribeca and is currently making the circuit. We're very excited to have it here. It celebrates and also tells the story of trans pioneer Marsha P. Johnson as well as Sylvia Rivera. It's a special film, indeed. And the question is being asked, who killed Marsha P. Johnson? And the self-described street queen of New York was found floating in the Hudson River in 1992, and the police called the death a suicide, and that was questioned, and rightfully so. And so the film examines that death as well as the activism of both Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera during that time.
Yeah, and really is an awesome insight into what was going on in New York. And actually, it's really interesting to see where trans rights and trans groups and trans celebrities and gay groups clashed as well within our own community. So, if you're interested in that history, particularly in New York City, it's post-Stonewall, it's a really great film for that.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that will get a lot of attention here in Portland, mm-hmm. which is a great thing.
I think so too. We hope so too. It's David France, who's Oscar nominated director, journalist. He's well known for How to Survive a Plague. It's his film, and he does great work, and this certainly is no exception, and it's an important film, and we encourage everyone to come see it. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And then if we need to lighten things up, we have the fabulous Alan Carr. it's actually called that, the fabulous Alan Carr. It's screening on Saturday at 9 p.m. This is Alan Carr was certainly a character in Hollywood. He basically was the mastermind behind Grease and Tommy and The Deer Hunter. And
Grease too, which is a movie I actually love.
You are one of few people. Funnily enough, the film talks about Grease too as well.
Exactly.
He's just a super interesting guy who really made a name for himself and made himself his own brand and person now in Hollywood, and then obviously the issues that he fought with around his own self-identity in that world. But just, on the lighter side, to see some of the clips from some of his productions is really, really entertaining in this film. Yeah.
And then to kind of walk through the debacle of the Academy Awards,
yes.
Which it's interesting though. It's debatable whether or not it was a debacle. It was. Some people loved it and some people hated it, and that's what made it talked about. But the movie's really fun, and it incorporates some really cool graphics and animated sequences along with the history of Alan Carr, and it's very much a Jeffrey Schwartz film. And he's known for Tab Hunter Confidential, as well as Vito. And Jeffrey Schwartz will join us for the film, which we're super excited to have him back. And it's a fun film. We're looking forward to it.
I don't need anybody to know this particularly, but it's very possible. Grease 2 is the movie I've seen more than any other.
How many times have you seen it, Alan?
Maybe a dozen.
I love that. I love that.
Well, we know.
Do you sing along?
No, not at all.
No? No. Okay. I've probably seen the original Grease that many times. I love it.
And then I don't know if we've mentioned, obviously, yet, but David Weissman, co-founder of the festival, has one of his films again this year, which is fantastic. It's part of his series of that's named Conversations with Gay Elders. We're going to leave that up to the audience to find out a little bit more about it because it has an incredible local relevance. It's going to be screening on Sunday, May 21st at noon, and it definitely has some, you know, some extremely local and very interesting subjects that he'll be interviewing in the film. So,
and he presented one in the series last year, didn't he?
He did, yeah, that's right. So this is part of the series.
That's right.
So we know that will be really popular.
Yeah, and that the idea there is really to make sure that these stories keep being told. And I mean, it's kind of exactly what it is, you know, Conversations with Gay Elders. It's pairing up. So David is paired up with Mikhail Thomas, who he premiered his film Game Face here 2 years ago. He's the editor on this particular second installment of Conversations with Gay Elders, and David, and then his conversation with his subject, and. It's very powerful, telling these stories, capturing these stories, documenting these stories, and then making sure our younger generation hears these stories, which, to be honest, is probably what QDoc is all about.
Yes, and then that brings us to the very important point that all youth under 23 get free tickets at QDoc, so please just email us to any film you like. So, yeah.
That's wonderful.
QDocFilmFestival.org, as you've heard, QDocFilmFest.org, and come to any films if you're under 23 for free.
That's wonderful. We're about to wrap up Preference. I'm Alan. We've been talking with Deb Kemp and Molly King. QDoc, Portland's Queer Documentary Film Festival, May 18 to 21.
You got it.
At the Hollywood.
All right. Hard Knock Radio is up next. We'll be back here with Preference in 3 weeks. Thank you so much, dear listeners. And tune in later this week to find out how you can become a contributing member of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. This year, the festival will be held June 30th through July 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 5-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.